But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Wealth Show podcast. My name is Sophie Downes. Today we are joined by the FCA's Nick Hume, Head of Advisors, Wealth and Pensions in the Consumer Investments Directorate at the FCA. In this very special two-part series, we'll talk about how the regulator is positioning for growth with a follow-up episode where Nick answers your questions. So welcome to the podcast, Nick. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, you're joining us today at what is quite a transformative time for the FCA. There's various changes happening and we'll come to specific initiatives shortly. But first, I want to focus on this idea of growth. It's become a bit of a buzzword in recent months. So to put it very simply, what does growth look like in this sector?
Sure. So, I mean, look, take it up a level for a second. You know, big picture, the UK, you know, we need economic growth. And, you know, without it, people have less money in their pockets. There's less money for public services. And financial services is a massive part of the economy, and it facilitates the other parts of the economy as well. So we want to help and lead both action and that discussion around what does growth look like to ensure that we do create this vibrant, growing, innovative market. And that's true of financial advice, but also more generally. So if you think about the wider investing landscape, biggest change to the listing rules in 30 years. You'd have seen the Prime Minister's letter on Christmas Eve, which was fantastically timed. Obviously, just before Christmas, where we set out 50 separate initiatives of growth. Mm-hmm. But I think more locally to your question, one of which was the Advice Guidance Boundary Review. Now, that's all about helping enable and create new opportunities for markets. So targeted support is the big piece in that, and we might come on to that in more detail. But it's not just about helping create new opportunities, new markets. It's also about helping the existing firms, the players in the market, grow where they can in a good way. So, you know, our review of consolidation is a good example of how we are trying to get out clear regulatory clarity on what good looks like, what good consolidation looks like. And then I think there's also a bit from a regulatory perspective about being a smarter regulator, about wanting to look at us, a bit of self-reflection, and think, how do we optimize our data? How do we streamline or reduce unnecessary burdens on financial advice firms? And I'm happy to talk about some of those recent initiatives, if that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be interesting to talk about, you know, you said about the 50 initiatives that have been laid out. What are the kind of biggest ones that you're focusing on right now that you think will help businesses in this sector grow?
Sure. So as I said, there's a whole host of big ticket items like the listing rule changes, like PICES, the Private Intermittent Securities Capital Exchange System, PICES for short, around getting, you know, more privately listed securities or the opportunity for trading in that. But I think if you think about the big one, it's got to be Advice Guidance Boundary Review. You know, that is about, you know, helping, you know, timely, affordable help for informed decisions and try and reduce that national advice gap. You know, 8% of people take advice each year, 4.6 million customers. How do we get to the other 92%? And, you know, the examples like targeted support, simplified advice, further clarification of the boundary is all about really trying to get into that. Make it that advice is more accessible. Find, I think this term is, you know, increase the number of stepping stones to holistic financial advice that I know so many of the listeners provide. And by doing that, more of the population is stepping on something rather than nothing. And that should hopefully push the wider growth prospects, not least, you know, if you think about it, hopefully with more advice, personal investments grow, good advice firm revenues grow, the UK economy, its capital markets grow. So, mm-hmm. so it's hopefully a win-win-win.
Mm-hmm. And I know we'll come back to the Advice Guidance Boundary Review because I know our listeners are particularly interested in hearing your thoughts on it. But I'm interested in what you said about turning the focus back on the regulator itself. Mm. So obviously, you know, we had Rachel Reeves' Mansion House speech in November where she said there wasn't, I quote, too much overlapping regulation, too much bureaucracy, and that the environment was currently a bit too slow for things to get done. Is it fair to say that the regulator had become unduly focused on risk at the expense of growth and innovation?
I think there is definitely more explicit focus on it now in the new strategy. I mean, the previous FCA strategy was a good basis for where we've got to. We were in the past looking at being a more adaptive, assertive regulator. Certainly if you look at the changes we made in enforcement, for example. But I think there's also a point where it's right to look at our national collective attitude to risk. It's right that we try and be part of that conversation or indeed lead that conversation. And I think too often, not just regulation, but others focus on risks of taking action rather than the risks of inaction. So, you know, regulation in the new strategy, the new 2030 strategy, is about mitigating excessive risk, but allowing and indeed enabling informed risk. And the new strategy is just more explicitly focused on that. And, you know, I'm happy to talk about that in more detail, but that is about turning the mirror on the regulator to be smarter. I'm happy to talk through that. It's also about supporting growth. It's about reducing financial crime to ensure we've got integrity in financial markets. Mm-hmm. And it's also about the day job of helping consumers navigate their financial lives. Mm-hmm. But I think the key here is, you know, we've got a more explicit focus on growth, and there are potential win-win-wins in this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen a lot of red tape being cut already. I think most recently, I think last week, in fact, the FCA announced a 70% reduction in kind of the legal text and requirements about regulatory capital rules.
Yeah.
So does simplifying requirements go far enough in reducing the burden on firms? And I guess as a second part to that, can we expect more of this going forward?
So the second question, absolutely. That is just the start. I mean, without boring your listeners too much with the alphabetti spaghetti of regulatory return numbers, but you know, there've been tangible action already. The regulator has, we stripped out three returns, FSA 39, RMAF, RDR Form G. That helps 16,000 firms have fewer regulatory returns in a year. As you mentioned, the 70% reduction on the legal text and the links to other regulations that didn't necessarily sufficiently be as relevant to investment firms because they were based on the capital requirement regulation. But I think also more generally, it is about understanding what is it that is most burdensome for firms. So we've got this, we're piloting this feedback tool at the moment, looking through what is it that you find most burdensome. Mm-hmm. And we're getting some really interesting comments in terms of specific returns, in terms of things we can do. But I also think there's another piece which isn't necessarily about streamlining or optimizing data. It's also about, you know, we've got the consumer duty now. So given that we have that, the bar should be higher for further rules or further policies or further supervisory approaches. So we're constantly asking ourselves now, is the consumer duty enough? And I think that's a really new, welcome, higher bar for any additional steps in the future.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, I guess, as the regulator, you have the dual responsibility of protecting consumers, but also facilitating an environment where firms can grow and where this is possible. So how do you make sure that red tape cutting doesn't lead people to lose trust in regulated firms?
Sure. I'd flip that slightly, actually, because I think, you know, no, I don't think anyone would say online or here that it would be wrong to remove, you know, over complex rules, unnecessarily prescriptive rules, duplicative stuff. So I think there's definitely something that we can do, as you're seeing at the moment, about streamlining and about optimizing. But it's also more than just about stripping back some, in a proportionate way, burden, in inverted commas. It's also looking at the other things that we do to ensure integrity of financial markets. So look at the action we've been taking just in the last couple of months in enforcement cases, for example. You know, look at the work that we've been putting out on making the polluter pay. So I know that's a big, important conversation topic for people, for firms doing the right thing in the financial advice space, where, you know, we don't want to see the levy, the FSCS levy increase for the actions of bad firms putting liabilities on good firms and the rest of the market. So it's all about all that assertive action that we take in supervision, we take in authorizations, we take overall at the regulator, and how we ensure that there is that market integrity piece to ensure that trust, that confidence in financial markets for actually not just customers and clients, but for the firms themselves that want to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm focusing on the FSCS in particular. Obviously, a few years ago, the FCA sent out to reduce the costs associated with this. Do you think that's still possible?
Yeah, look, I think it's tricky to always find an explicit link between the work that we do in supervision at the regulator and the FSCS levy. It's impossible for us to stop all firm failure. That's not in our remit. That wouldn't be the right thing. Our job is to try, when firms do fail, that there is a managed failure such that it's not disorderly, and that we try and minimize the impact on others. And one of those things is the FSCS levy. The levy has come down. It's almost halved since 2021-22, so it's about $394 million now. But like I said, I would point to the work that we've been doing publicly about making the polluter pay. And there's a really good page on our website called that that I think came out in January this year. But you know, we are as alert as we have always been in terms of phoenixing, in terms of lifeboating, and we will our authorization colleagues and us in supervision are very much alert to it. And look, if you as firms ever come across issues that you think that the regulator may not be aware of, tell us. You know, you've got that whistle at fca.org.uk anonymous route, or you've got other, your more normal routes to talk to us in supervision.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think moving on to consumer duty a bit more, obviously, you've been engaging with the industry in person recently, having held a series of roadshows across the UK. Tell us a bit about the purpose of these events, you know, what went into it and what you've been hearing from wealth firms.
Sure. So this is my favourite question, if I'm honest, because I think the most powerful thing that we have sought to do and resource up in supervision and the regulator is getting out and about to see firms. That is the feedback that we've been getting. So we are coming to Northern Ireland, to Scotland, to Wales, to everywhere in England. And the roundtables we've done so far, predominantly on the wealth management side. The ones in the latter half of this year will be more on the advisor side. But really, what I would just say is the construct is quite a simple one, which is just people coming to meet together to talk about stuff. Actually, what's happened is even more powerful than that. You've got supervisors local to wealth management and financial advice, knowledgeable about those issues, meeting with practitioners, you know, the firms themselves, again, local to financial advice and wealth management, talking through case studies, real life, albeit we've anonymized them, case studies about local issues to financial advice and wealth management. And the power that has brought has been fantastic, and the feedback has been really, really great, because what it allows us to do is actually not just say these are our priorities and everyone else go away and think, right, okay, what does that mean for us? Actually, what it's saying is let's work together and unpick that, explain why we're coming to that. So we'll share some data, we'll share some insights, but it's also the peer review or the peer input around the table and some own self-reflection from the delegates that have gone, wow, okay, I've taken 4 or 5 practical hints and tips away with me today. And that's what we want. That's, I know, what financial advice firms and wealth managers want. They want those hints, those tips. And I'm pleased to say that's certainly what the feedback is showing at the moment. And we can get out some of our more localized messages around vulnerability, around price and value, around financial crime in a way that is way more targeted. So I'm thank you for that question, because that's that's my soapbox.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you've spoken previously about how around the topic of vulnerability, you were quite surprised to hear some wealth firms believing that it perhaps wasn't applicable to work they were doing. Were there any other surprises during these roadshows that you encountered, or anything that maybe you weren't expecting to hear from the wealth sector?
From the wealth sector specifically? No, I think on vulnerability, it was one of the reasons why we shared those statistics back 18 months ago was that we were struggling to understand ourselves why that might be the case. And it's been great to work with industry, to work with trade bodies, to try and unpick that for everyone as to what was going on there. Mm-hmm. And so being able to do these work case studies has been really beneficial, and the numbers have increased. So the total number of clients with vulnerabilities as a percentage of total retail clients in the sector, which was less than 1% 18 months ago, based on data that has come from firms, is now around 5%. There's still a bit of a way to go on that, because whilst there's not necessarily a specific number to aim for, you know, 50% of us are going to be vulnerable in our lifetimes at some point. 30% of people with investable assets of more than 50,000 have an acknowledgeable characteristic of vulnerability. So there's still definitely work to do, but these roadshows about finding hints, finding tips, just, you know, I've heard a number of people say, yes, I've got a couple of things that I'm going to take away and I'm going to play that back. Because I can't stress this enough, vulnerability is the lens through which we are looking at firms' overall implementation of the duty. Mm-hmm. Because if a firm can't get vulnerability right, and particularly the identification bit right, then how is it really getting the concept of target market identification, client segmentation right? You know, vulnerability is one thing that goes across all of the four consumer duty outcomes. So I think for me, I've slightly hijacked your question there and just focused on vulnerability, but that has been a really positive thing where people have been going away actually with some tangible hints and tips on the thing that is, you know, we are using as a sense check, a cross check, the lens through which we're judging firms' implementation of the duty overall.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to share any of the best practices that you were finding in the firms who are best, you know, kind of encountering vulnerable clients?
100%. So, I mean, there's some guidance that's been put out centrally from the FCA, which I'd definitely recommend people look at. There's also the finalized guidance. I'm going to get the number wrong. 21/1, I think, which again is the sort of full script of good tips and guidance from a few years back. The other thing I would just say is, I'm happy to give some examples. You know, we've seen things like training specific to a firm's target market. So we've seen firms proactively approach charities, Age UK, for example, and say, actually, we think our target market could really, our advisors could do with some training specific to our target market around the signs for onset dementia, for example. So we've seen things like that. We've seen people look at their totality of touch points because some have less or fewer touch points than others and think, right, every moment, how can we best try and identify potential triggers? I'd also recommend reading the cross-industry guide that PIMFA put out back in October. There's a speech, vulnerability is not a buzzword. We've got some examples in there. I quote this IFA from Harrogate who said, I didn't know whether I was doing enough on vulnerability. And he, with the consumer duty mindset, which is outcomes rather than how you get there, he thought, right, well, how do I know? How am I giving myself independent challenge that I'm doing the right thing for my clients with characteristics of vulnerability or in circumstances of vulnerability? And so he took them out to lunch. He took them out to lunch and asked them, what am I doing well? What could I do better? And he found that, again, you know, practical examples, really, 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 really powerful. And that sort of independent cross-check with people that know it the most. I am not for one second saying, sitting here, FCA tells industry to take their clients out to lunch before there's some sort of headlight along that side. But definitely there are sort of a few examples of how the consumer duty is getting into people's mindset of it's about the outcome and how you get there rather than a level of prescription along the way. The last thing I would say as a plug, come to the roundtables. Vulnerability is absolutely front and center, and we'll be sharing more of the examples I've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. And I'm intrigued to hear, Nick, did you find any disparity between some of the smaller and larger firms in dealing with vulnerability? Because I think it's fair to say, you know, there is the perception that smaller firms kind of struggle mm-hmm. with perhaps the burden of regulation more than the larger ones. So did you find that? And I suppose, is there, or what resources would you recommend for those smaller sure. firms who maybe do struggle?
I don't think there was a clear delineation between small and large. I mean, I know that smaller firms will feel the forces of regulation a bit more keenly sometimes. I get that. But that's why we've got our proportionality focus. That's why in our supervision, we are very focused on looking at the totality of a firm, its complexity, its size, and establishing what is reasonable. What would be reasonable to expect? Mm-hmm. So, and again, I think the consumer duty really helps us on that front. As for examples, again, I've listed a few. I would really engage with the PIMFA guide, the two things on our website, FG21/1, and the more recent vulnerability review. And yeah, come along to our roadshows somewhere near you. We are strategically trying to find locations around the country that are closest to the greatest number of firms, whether that's IFAs or larger.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose in you know, doing the roadshows, you're seeing the firms firsthand as the industry is changing. And I actually wanted to ask about this and whether, you know, the FCA is concerned about the number of advice and wealth firms that are owned by private equity investors. Obviously, we've seen kind of a rise in this.
Sure. We are completely agnostic to consolidation. What we want at the end of the day is good outcomes. Mm-hmm. So we want good growth and we want good consolidation. You know, there are benefits to consolidation. There's diversity of choice. There's scale. There's competitiveness. There's exit routes to IFAs, as an example. So we want a diversity of firms at the end of the day to achieve what we want to achieve on the advice guidance boundary review, you know, reduce that national advice gap. It's going to be firms that are looking to grow and identify new markets that are potentially going to be able to unlock that and help. The other thing I would say, yes, there is a total reduction in the number of firms, but actually that can just be market dynamics at play. The number of advisors has actually stayed relatively steady, if not increasing, and the number of people taking ongoing advice has actually increased in previous year, from previous years. So we hope that our multi-firm review, which is ongoing at the moment, gives that regulatory clarity to firms looking to grow, looking to not just consolidate, but grow organically as well. So they know what good looks like, but they also know that we will remediate where we see bad consolidation, bad growth. And they know that we're keeping a level playing field in the market. I guess I almost sometimes get the flip of that question, which would be remiss of me not to talk about, which is, do you only want to see big firms in the market? And again, that's absolutely not the case. Just to reiterate that first point, we want all types of firms of all sizes. The advice gap requires it.
Okay, perfect. And then I think a final question to end it on. A lot of people in the industry will be listening to this. So as a final note to end, if you could communicate one thing to firms, what would you like them to know about the work that you're doing?
Sure. So I got some feedback that it was nice to know the FCA isn't an amorphous blob. So that, you know, we are people just like financial advisors, just like wealth managers. We want to help people. We want to help people live better lives, and you know, navigate financial services in the best way possible. Yes, our day jobs are different. We're a regulator. We try and identify and weed out the bad. You focus on your clients. But actually, there's a whole, you know, huge set of shared objectives there. We're, you know, between regulator and regulated, our objectives are pretty aligned. And we want to help raise standards together. We want to get out and about. And we're also prepared to be different as well. You know, we are serious about, I think in October when we issued the supervisory strategy for the financial advice sector, the strap line was, it's good to be different. Well, it's good to be different. We need to be different. We all do. We need to work together. And so you will see a regulator that is more open to informed risk. you'll see a regulator that is, you know, more explicit in its support for growth, less prescriptive given the duty, and that we want to get out and about more, because only working together, you know, continuously in person, not infrequently and remote, can we really build the necessary relationships to sort of deal with these big challenges that we all share ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's quite a positive note to end on. So that's all we have time for in this segment, but stay tuned for the second episode where Nick will be answering your questions.
But today is VE Day. The boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
landed. Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.